Okay, let's start. Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Apparently the microphone is not charged again, so I'll have to stand here in front of the microphone and try not to move. Can you hear me in the back? Yes, okay, good. Right, welcome to week 5 and the 4th lecture. I'll start it with some organizational matters, very little in fact, sorry about that, about the noise, not the organizational matters. What's going on here? No. Okay, don't know what's going on here. Anyway, let's try again. As you know from looking at the schedule, there is an assignment coming your way. I didn't put it on the schedule in the sense of that you don't know when exactly it's coming. Well, it's coming very soon. In fact, I'll be uploading it over the weekend. It is something that all BA and BEd students will have to do in order to be allowed to take the exam at the end of the course. As I said, I'll upload it over the weekend. I will then also, depending on when I upload it, announce the deadline, and I will make sure that this is on, well, both on StudIP and also that you'll get an email that alerts the people who may not be present. It's not obligatory for students who are retaking this course for whatever reason. Maybe if you, I don't know, need to do the exam again or something like that. If you've already done this in the previous version of the course with Professor Sant, for example, then that's fine. You don't need to redo it. The type of assignment it is well, it is, it's something like, well, it's basically a library assignment, but, stop, no. I know you've done this several times, and I know this is very annoying, yes. However, what I'd like to do is that it makes sure that you know where the linguistics stuff are. Yeah? And it will ask you to do some things with databases that you may not come across. You need to know where the linguistics books are. You need to know where to find information on the internet or with databases that we have that you will not otherwise find. And yes, there are one or two probably fairly tedious questions in there, but there are the large majority is really intended to expose you to something which I am afraid you will otherwise not find ever. Some of the old type students, the different degree schemes that we had, managed to get to their final exams in their, I don't know, 12th or 13th semester sometimes, and they have not heard of, I don't know, the MLA database, for example. That's not good, and that's why I would like to expose you to this very early on. Okay. We're also supposed to an STS assignment explicitly, not content, but more like study and transferable skills, as it's called. That's why we're doing a library assignment, but as I said, it's to do with linguistic-specific items. Yeah. You'll then need to hand this in. You'll need to hand it in to my secretary, who is on the third floor. Again, this will be marked. She's not in the English department, but she's somewhere close by, and I think it was one of the tasks of finding her office in one of, the literature? Now you all know where she is. That's where you'll have to hand in the assignment. Okay. There will be a second assignment later on in the course, which is then linguistic, specifically, and that will only be obligatory for students who are BA students and not the BEd students. Because BA students receive more credit for this course. There will also be a bit later on, there will be a bit more reading for those students as well. Okay? That's basically what I wanted to say about organization. Wait a minute, am I here? Today my... Okay, I may have to restart this again, but it doesn't matter. Today you'll get more on phonology, which I already started last week. I'll say a few things about syllables and syllable structure, which is not in the reading for today, which is in fact in a chapter that I won't be asking you to read, at least if I remember correctly. But it's still something that I find useful for you to know. Not absolutely essential, but useful to know. And again, I will make it clear what is absolutely essential and what is not via the no list. And then towards the end of the lecture, we're going to concentrate on connected speech and on what happens when you don't just pronounce a single word and transcribe that, but what changes when, well, you produce several words string together, and, well, basically what happens when you talk normally. You'll get more detail on the basics. You'll also get more detail on the basics, but you will get more than just the basics. I know some of you are overwhelmed by the amount of information that you're receiving. That's normal, in the sense that you're going to be getting this throughout the course. The pace is not going to get slower, which is also why I would like to encourage you to take care of things as the course goes along, and not to say, well, the exam is at the end of the semester, I'll just sit in and listen a bit, but I won't deal with the content until I prepare for the exam. If you do this, you're going to find it difficult, really difficult. You need to do this as we go along, okay? Because it's just too much. Okay. Right. What did we do in the last lecture? I went through a description of each sound, or at least of most, well, of the relevant sounds for English. And we looked at place of articulation, manner of articulation. We looked at voicing, of course, only in consonants, because all vowels are voiced anyway. And we also, I didn't actually mention this in any great detail, but remember in the IPA, there are some vowels with two dots, and that indicates lengthening. I think I briefly mentioned this, but I didn't concentrate on this very much. Well, I mentioned IPA. Yes, that's what I introduced you to last time. The International Phonetic Alphabet, which is used worldwide and therefore useful as a sort of general reference. You will find other transcriptions, as I indicated last time, and in fact you might even be confronted with other transcriptions by other instructors at this department, because, for example, they're using a dictionary that uses one or two other symbols than what I've introduced. This is something you'll have to accept, and once you know, I don't know, this symbol is the one that is equivalent to the other, then you'll be fine. As I said, I only introduced sounds that are relevant for English, and towards the end of the lecture, I moved over from phonetics, which is just describing sounds and how we produce them, towards phonology, and that's where I need to talk, well, where I need to give you more information. Now, I just need to briefly break this off because I'm supposed to see something on my screen, which I don't, so I'm just wondering whether I can change this. Maybe if you give me just 1 minute to do this, sorry. Okay, I don't manage, but yeah, It's a new version of the tool that I'm using. It's not PowerPoint, it's Keynote, and I need to look into it. Because I have little notes sometimes on the slides that I see, which remind me of one or two things that are not on the slides that I need to tell you. I don't see them now, so I'll have to make do without them. Why am I showing this to you again? This is what I introduced as the vowel space and the way to symbolize or to organize the IPA symbols related to where they are produced in where the individual sounds or the vowels are produced in the mouth. There was a bit of confusion. One or two people asked me about these, the two here, the face and the goat vowel, which are in fact not face and goat, but face and goat. Remember that I introduced those two as being particularly northern in standard, well, in RP or in standard southern British English, these would be actually diphthongs in those words. Just to remind you, this is something which is specific to the book that we're using because it was written at Lancaster University. Lancaster University is in the north of England, and that's why the people who work there are more aware, or not only aware, but more, well, on a daily basis exposed to northern English, and that's why they think it's important to mention it. But in normal or in many other descriptions of the vowel space of English, you will not find those two symbols. Right. A bit of revision. One of the terms that I introduced last time was that of the minimal pair. And I know from the tutorial feedback that I get that not everyone understood what I meant by minimal pair. Are these minimal pairs? You should now be able to read them. And in fact, even if you couldn't pronounce them on the basis of making sense of them, you should still... There it is again. Thank you. Another person. This is going to be the theme of this lecture, right? I'll miss it if someone doesn't do it once. Okay. Bless you. Even if you couldn't read it, if you couldn't pronounce it, you should still be able to answer the question, are these minimal pairs? Who thinks that the first two are minimal pairs? Is a set of minimal pairs? Okay. A few people are putting up their hands. Who thinks they're not? Okay, one couple of them. Who doesn't know? Right, okay, a couple as well. What about the second? Who thinks that they're minimal pairs? Yeah, slightly fewer, but yes, generally. Okay. Well, team and deem, and thy and thy, the old-fashioned pronoun, thy name be hallowed. Yes, they're minimal pairs. Both these sets are minimal pairs. Why? Because there is only one element, one phoneme, which is different. Today I'm having problems with my... Yeah, okay. In fact, that's a term that I think I didn't introduce last time. Minimal pair, of course, is two, but in fact we can even talk about a minimal set when we've got three or more words which can only, which are only distinguished by one element, by one phoneme. Now, why do we need minimal pairs? Or what can we do with these? We can use these to determine whether the thing that changes is a phoneme in English, is something that is meaning distinguishing, that creates two different words. Okay. Whether I say t, the voiceless, or d, the voiced plosive, in team or deem, produces, well, one of those two words, and they're different words in English. That suggests that the distinction between, the phonetic distinction between the voiceless and the voiced plosive is a distinction between two phonemes in English. Minimal pairs must have the same number of phonemes. There was a question from one or two people, or from one person doing the tutorial, whether something like gain and grain is a minimal pair. The answer is no, because there is an extra phoneme in grain. Yes, r is a phoneme, and you can create minimal pairs. But it adds something. It's not the same number, and therefore we're not talking about a minimal pair. What about Spain and pain? Some people shake their heads. Yes, again, it's not the minimal pair. Yes, one thing is different, but again, we're adding something, and therefore it's not the same number of phonemes. There is also a difference with respect to how the P is produced. Again, we've got one P at the beginning of a syllable, and the second one, the first one is where it's not at the beginning. And there will be difference in terms of aspiration. But that's not a question of whether it's a phoneme or not. That's when we're talking about allophones. And I'll mention that again in a minute. What about phone and fine? Who thinks that this is a minimal pair? Very few people. Who thinks it's not a minimal pair? Okay, the others don't care, or or just don't want to decide? Yeah. Well, yes, it is a minimal pair. Why is it a minimal pair? Because remember that last time when I introduced diphthongs, in fact quite a few Brits say diphthongs, I think the Americans as well, the majority say diphthongs, apparently according to the pronunciation dictionary, but both diphthongs and diphthongs is fine. Diphthongs are vowels where the movement, where there's some movement, from one sound to the next, but it's really only one sound, it's only one phoneme. And therefore, phone and fine differ with respect to exactly one phone, even though, of course, the diphthongs are made up of two elements, but they belong together and therefore are one sound, so to speak. What about key and cow? Who thinks it's a minimal pair? More people should now feel confident. No? Okay, who thinks it's not a minimal pair? Why? Why? Yeah? Which ones? How many sounds are there in each word? Yeah?
There are only two.
Oh. Oh, yes. Okay. Remember, spelling, first of all, I mean, it's not only here, but spelling doesn't help. Okay. Yeah? But spelling does not necessarily help with pronunciation. Yes, there is something. I mean, with key, we have a monophthong. We have a vowel during which nothing happens in the mouth, really. E. And with cow, we have a diphthong. Ow. But as I just said, diphthongs are individual phonemes, and therefore, E and ow changes one sound. I'm absolutely sure that you'll find a few linguists who think that's wrong and that diphthongs should be treated differently, but that's the general assumption among most linguists. Okay. Last question, symbol and simple. think that was discussed in one of the tutorials. Who's in favor of this being a minimal pair? Yeah. Few people. Who thinks it's not? Okay, the others again don't know. Yes, it is a minimal pair. Now, I had to check this myself, because there are sort of minor distinctions, but these are not phonemic distinctions. It would go into too much detail to discuss this, but in both cases there is some sort of ul, but the ə is really very, very short, so it's really only the L, which is almost like a syllable, which is syllabic, as we'll mention later on. So yes, this is a minimal pair as well. Okay. I hope the concept is clear now, and I also hope the reason why we need minimal pairs will become clearer if it isn't yet. Okay. Now, I've already today mentioned this concept of meaning distinguishing unit. That's something that you need to know. A phoneme is meaning distinguishing. It doesn't carry meaning. A doesn't carry any meaning, or B. But by using this rather than another phoneme, we can create a different word, and that different word has a different meaning. Therefore, phonemes are meaning distinguishing units of a language. And I made the point that different sounds may be differently arranged in different languages. And I gave you the example of the Spanish B and V distinction, which doesn't exist, but which is so obvious for us non-Spanish speakers. We made the point last time, or we discussed this in some detail, that phonemes can be realized differently, but then that all these different realizations, for example, whether it's aspirated or not, are all examples or uses or types they're all the same on one level, in the sense that whether it's aspirated or, I can't do this without vowels or syllables, full syllables, it's still the same phoneme. So the different realizations are different phones that are grouped together in a language. And the textbook that we used to use for this course, the expensive one that I didn't want you to buy because it costs 129 euros, talks about sounds in the mind. And I think I like that metaphor. I like that way of talking about it, because the sounds themselves are independent, but in the mind they're part of a system. Okay. I also introduced you to what I would call the broad phonetic transcription. So we talked about things like bilabial voiceless plosives. And remember, I said that you need to be able to describe consonants and vowels on the basis of what I introduced, of these manner and place of articulation. You'll get, I can't remember how many points again, but these are easy points to get in the exam. But I also introduced you to this difference between aspirated versus non-aspirated plosive, depending on whether it's at the beginning of a syllable or of a word or not. And I made the point that these two variants cannot, in English, be used to create a new word, to create different words, or in other words, to create minimal pairs. And that's why we call them allophones. Later on, we will actually have allomorphs. It's the same, just on a different level. That's a point I will make repeatedly throughout the course, that there are parallels on different levels of description. Sounds fairly theoretical now, but I hope it becomes clearer. Now, in this case, as I've already indicated, the choice between aspiration and non-aspiration depends on where it is in the syllable, if it's at the beginning of the syllable or not. In Finnegan, the textbook that we're not using, on page 109, he lists this overview of words, or this table of words that contain aspirated and non-aspirated instances of the plosive p. Can you try to work out whether it's just position in the syllable or whether it depends on something else? I mean, if I'm asking like that, obviously it'll depend on something else, but what is it? Just have a look at those words. So all the ones in the first column are aspirated. What's the difference between the one in the first and in the second column, which also have an aspirated t at the beginning? What's the difference? I think I heard it. This is one of the few moments where you're actually supposed to talk. Nobody? Okay, I'll help you out. Yes, I heard it. Didn't I hear stress? Pedigree versus petunia, or paternal, or peninsula versus persecute. Now, in both cases, the P is stressed. No, sorry, the P is aspirated. Emporium, computer, aspirated. Rapid, empathy, competition. Again, if you were to try this out, you would notice that in the last column, we have no aspiration. And that's not just got to do with the position in the syllable, because there too, it's at the beginning of the syllable, but it's in an unstressed syllable. Yeah, does that make sense? Yeah. Now, I made the point last time that we have a choice between pit, which is aspirated, and spit, where the p is not aspirated. And that it, in fact, doesn't work the other way around. I may not have mentioned explicitly, but that's actually the case, right? You can't really say... Well, no, you can't. I can't. spit? No, right? At least I can't do this very well. Maybe speakers of other languages can, which... I mean, these languages may not have that distinction, or may use this as a meaningful or meaning-distinguishing criterion. In other words, these two allophones are in what's called complementary distribution. Depending on whether it's at the beginning of a syllable that's stressed or at the beginning of a word, it'll always be aspirated. And if it's not, then it won't be. And it's not that they're interchangeable. So the position, there are certain characteristics, we could call them distributional characteristics, where it is in the word, that decide on which of the two allophones are used. Is that clear? It's not always the case. That's usually the case, in fact. And I'll give you a few more examples, which are one of these sort of nice-to-have knowledge category type of information, but not, just to make the point. Some people make a distinction, well, not a distinction, but use, particularly in connected speech, they might say mop, or they might just have, well, it's difficult for me to produce this, but mop. Well, it's almost like no audible release. And you could say that when the plosive is still there, but you hardly hear it. And you could say that this is also the same thing. I mean, the word doesn't change, but it's acoustically realized differently. And therefore, these are also allophones of the same phoneme. But it's not dependent on where in the word it occurs. And these ones are called, well, this type of distribution is called free variation. The norm, when we talk about allophones, is complementary distribution. I also indicated last time, or gave you the example last time, of the glottal stop, the wo or bo o, right? The kind of, rather than t. And I said that this is a, these are two allophones of the phoneme t. Is this a case of complementary distribution? No, it isn't. Because it doesn't depend on, well, there is choice of, for speakers between whether they want to say water bottle or water bottle. And therefore it can't be complementary distribution. Is this free variation? Well, yes, on a certain level, but it's also indicative of who you are, where you come from, where you live. It's more likely to happen in areas of London than in certain other parts of the country. It also depends on social class, age, etc. Now, this is what you'll be talking about in social linguistics next semester, among other things. Right. Now, I'd like to introduce a few more allophones to get the concept across to you in a, I hope, useful way. Can you think about whether there are differences in producing these words with respect to the phoneme that's shared by all of them, which is, well, realized by the letter L, or we could call it the phoneme L. Is that always produced or pronounced in the same way? And can you find out why not, if it isn't? And of course, again, since I'm asking the question like that, there is going to be a difference. But what is the difference? Yeah? Yes? Yeah, towards the back. Yeah. Okay, so you introduce the technical terms, the dark L, yeah, and that seems to depend on the position of what? The tongue during the production of the vowel, right? If the vowel is a back vowel, we have a dark L. If it's a front one, we don't have a dark L. Now, so we have milk, milk, rather than milk, milk, milk. Well, I'm overdoing this now, but... Can we find a minimal pair with L and L? No. The clear L precedes a vowel. Actually, yes, now I'm making... Wait a minute, is this about back and front? No, I think I've mixed up something, right? Milk, 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 leak, leak, milk. No, I made a mess. Okay. This is about whether it's preceding or following a vowel. Yeah. There are some cases about some allophones that depend on the position of the tongue. No, this is about whether it precedes or follows a vowel. Yeah, it's independent of whether it's a front or a back vowel. But the principle is the same. Sorry. Yeah. And I think you already mentioned the concept, or not the concept, but the position of this being, this having to do with the velar part of the velum, right? Did I get you right there? I think so, yeah. Now this is why, and this is not a term you need to actively know, but I think it should make sense. This is the term, well, the term that we use to describe is velarization. So the sound is produced with a more velar quality than not. Okay. But the important bit is whether it is produced with this velar quality or not doesn't change whether it's the phoneme L or not. It just changes the realizations realization in complementary distribution. Does that make sense? I hope so. There's only one phoneme that's involved. Teeth versus tool, peel versus pull, kill versus call. Again, are there any differences between the first sounds of these pairs or words? The second words of these sets always contain something. They have something in common. A rounded vowel, yeah? Okay, is that what you wanted to say? Something like that. Okay, good, yeah. Right. So, remember, some vowels have, well, are produced with rounded lips. And that seems to influence the preceding consonant. So if you say tool versus teeth, then the T is produced actually slightly differently. It's very difficult to notice this because it's sort of part of the vowel, but it seems to be influenced. You can measure this acoustically with the adequate tools in phonetics, in acoustic phonetics. And this lip rounding, which has an influence on the quality of the consonant, is what we call labialization. Okay? Again, not a term that you need to know by heart and need to define, but I think the concept, again, makes sense in this discussion of allophones and phonemes. The way to annotate this would be to put a little W behind the T to indicate, like the aspiration with the H, to indicate that the T is somewhat differently produced, namely with a rounded quality. And this again is a rule, in fact a phonological rule, not a phonetic rule, but a phonological rule which is relevant for English. Before rounded vowels, all consonants undergo labialization, and all consonants will therefore be produced as allophones of their unrounded counterparts. And I've already said that they are therefore then allophones. Why does this happen? Well, we'll be talking more about assimilation or various types of assimilation later on today. This has got to do with ease of pronunciation. If the lips have to be rounded anyway, then why not just round them early on? It's easier than to change sort of two things. How would you transcribe the word open? Some of you would probably say open, right? But if you listen carefully how I produced it, then I didn't actually say open, but I said open, open, right? I don't really produce a schwa. What I really produce is just an m after the p. It's as if the whole syllable was in a consonant. What kind of sound is m? It's a nasal. And in fact, what we have here is a syllabic nasal, a word final nasal that follows another consonant. That's also a case of assimilation. Is that specific to English? Do we have this in German? If you say haben, haben, you don't say haben, haben, right? You don't say vernünftig, vernünftig, it's an M, right? Yeah. We're already getting into this sort of question of what happens when you connect different phonemes and, in fact, later on, different words in connected speech. And assimilation is one of the processes that work then. A few more rules, and again, rules that I don't expect you to know by heart, but that makes sense, I think, in this discussion. Well, makes sense to mention them. We've seen that vowels can be long or short. Diphthongs are long by default. Is vowel length contrastive in English? Or in other words, is vowel length phonemic? Is it? Can you have a short vowel and a long vowel as for this, of the as a short and a long version of the same vowel and create a minimal pair? No. You used to be able to do this in Old English. Well, not you, but 1,500, 2,000 years ago. Vowel length was phonemic. You could create minimal pairs. But today, in English, this is no longer possible. In other languages, it is. Vowel length isn't random, though. Wing, bang, strength, hung. They're okay. Wing, barn, strength. I don't know. It's difficult for me to produce this. What's? Thank you. Thank you for helping. Yes. What's the problem here? Wing. Why doesn't that work? Why does barn not work? Well, whoever is helping me, do they know the answer? Vowels before m must be short. It's just a rule in English. Okay. A rule not to apply sort of, well, that you learn this actively, but this just seems to be the case in the system of English. We can have vowels that are long in words like see, bar, law, and stray. But unlike probably Chinese and other languages, we don't have words like see, be, or ba, or ba, well, yeah, ba. Lo, stray. Si, ba, lo, not long, sorry. Short. It's been a long week. But we have sip, bat, bat, lock, and stress. But we don't have sip, bat, lo, and stray. Now I have it. Okay. Why? Because if it's monosyllabic and if they're content words with open syllables, long vowels, there will be long vowels and diphthongs. The short vowel is only possible if a consonant is added. What's an open syllable? An open syllable is one which doesn't end in a consonant. Okay, these rules I don't expect you to know actively. This one I really expect you to know about. The vowel in an unstressed syllable becomes a schwa. And I think I briefly mentioned this in the last lecture already when I introduced the schwa. And I think one of the words that we looked at was photography or photograph. And you can, if you produce the two, then you can see that the same vowel, well, it isn't the same vowel, because in an unstressed position, the vowel which is produced as a full version, so to speak, is reduced to a schwa. Photography, photography versus photograph. Or library versus librarian. Okay. So, the transcription would make a distinction between a diphthong when it is stressed, but in the unstressed photography, it is a schwa. Some people have had enough. Library versus librarian, same thing. If you need to check the transcriptions, I'll upload, of course, as always, these slides to StudIP. The point that I've repeatedly made is that different languages have different phonemes. Or the same phones, but different phonological rules is another way of putting this. How do German speakers produce the English words kids and kits? Many German speakers have problems distinguishing between the two, or producing something which distinguishes between the two in the phonemic sense. Because they produce both plosives as voiceless plosives, and then talk about kits. Or jazz is not jazz, but something like chat. Well, I can't even. Chess. Which sounds like the game. And that's because German doesn't have certain phonemic contrasts which exist in English. And that's why it's difficult to get native-like pronunciation, because your system, your brain is so much used to the phonemic contrasts that we have in German. English speakers, on the other hand, have problems with saying things like tsar, which will then be czar, because there is no ts at the beginning of syllables in English. And don't try to ask a German, an English speaker to say München, right? There's no sh. And there's no U. Right? That's why it's Munich. Because the same phonemes just don't exist. This also applies to different dialects, of course, and that's also in the reading for today, which makes a difference between RP, which hardly anyone speaks anymore, but Southern Standard British English, Northern varieties, and I already introduced the phonemic difference. But in fact, there are also, of course, more subtle differences. But yeah, the phonemic difference is the important bit. And American English is very different. In fact, American English doesn't have the same number of diphthongs as British English. These ones are absent. Here. Here, etc. They just don't form part of the phonemic system of American English. Why? Well, because American is what's called a rhotic dialect. Rhoticity. So there's a difference between the standard Southern British English fear, or care, and the general American, where you hear the R, fear, or something like that. I'm not erotic. Well, to some extent I am, but not fully. So what's actually a diphthong in standard Southern British English is not in American English. And that's because the post-vocalic R, which used to be the norm, has been lost in Britain, largely. There are some areas, southwest, Cornwall and other places, and also some pockets around Lancashire, where and in the north as well, where you find this. And I think I briefly mentioned this in the first lecture. And in American English, in most areas of America, not around the area of Boston, but in most others. There are further distinctions or further differences. What's the difference between the vowels in these two words in American English? In British English, it would be card and cord. In American English, they're the same. Ask someone like Bill Argent to produce this for you. Or, what's the difference between the ladder and the latter in British English, in American English? None, because both are produced with the, well, in the same way, this ladder, right? Yeah. This North American tap, which I think I briefly introduced already. What does this mean? It basically means that American English doesn't have certain phonemic contrasts that British English has. So we have a technical term is a neutralization of a phonemic contrast. Something that Brits distinguish, or a phoneme that can be used to distinguish between, or two different phonemes that produce minimal pairs, do not exist in American English. Okay, I think we need a 2-minute break. How about transcribing those? Or not, depending on whether you want to do this. I'll just be quiet for 2 minutes. Okay, break's over. Now, if you thought about how to transcribe these words, then maybe you decided to do it this way. Table, there is what? There is an L with this dot at the bottom of the last item. What does this indicate? Well, it's again one of these sort of syllabic L's, right? If you put a schwa and an L, I mean, I would accept this, but I think it's more accurate to say that this is a syllabic L. Mm. For water, you have a choice between water or water. You could have transcribed it with a glottal stop. Notice that I put square brackets around this, because this is a phonetic transcription. It's not a phonemic transcription. If it is a phonemic transcription, I would have had to use the symbol t. Yeah? Because the glottal stop is one of the allophones of that phoneme. And even if someone says wo-o with a glottal stop, the phonemic transcription is still with a T sound, well, not the T sound, the T symbol, because as a convention that's what's used. Theoretically, we could use a glottal stop as well as a convention for all t instances, but it makes more sense the other way around. Laugh, the way I produced it now, laugh, with a long R. In fact, if you are a northerner, then you would say laugh, shorter and higher, laugh. Northerners also say castle. They don't say castle, they say castle. My sons have lost that now, unfortunately. I liked it. There's also something about certain speakers in the north of how they produce there and fur, there and fur. Now this is probably how you would transcribe it if it was Southern Standard British English, with the nurse vowel in the second one, in fur. But in fact, many particularly working class speakers of Northern English will produce the same, and I can't even do this, but I know a colleague in Lancaster who does this. He says there, not as there, but as the, something like that. It sounds much more natural when he does it. Mm-hmm. Again, reducing a phonemic distinction. But again, that's restricted to Northern English. Okay, a few things about syllables, and I'll do this fairly quickly. This is extra material, so to speak, because it makes some points that I think are interesting. But again, this is not something that I would like you to know by heart. It doesn't mean that you don't have to listen, but anyway, I just thought it was... it's in the chapter that it's not for not required reading. Well, I think that's an easy enough concept, monosyllabic versus polysyllabic words, whether it's one or several syllables. How many syllables? Even that, I think, is very easy. Understand. Sending. Why did I say sending and not sending? I think everyone would have said sending. But why? What are the syllable boundaries? Or why not sending? Again, these are regularities in English that can help decide this. No, still hasn't realized? Now she has realized. Okay. Either outside or down here, please. No, you don't have to go, but chatting outside, listening here, please. Yes, you. Okay. Right. Where was I? Now, syllables have a structure, and knowing more about the structure can tell you more about what belongs to to a syllable or not. A few technical terms, onset and rhyme. Onset, I think, makes sense because it's the beginning of a syllable. And there is a nucleus and a coda. The onset, as I said, is the beginning. The nucleus is the element that's required. Later on, when we do syntax, there will also be sort of a head, an important bit that cannot be left out of a phrase. And that we will call head. But here it's called nucleus. But in a way, you could also say it's the head of the syllable. What do we have with lay? Well, we have an onset as well. We have a rhyme. But we only have a nucleus, but the nucleus consists of two parts which, as we now know, is in fact one phoneme, namely a diphthong. So in a way that contradicts something that I've said before, but it's to do with syllable structure. In fact, even C, which is the long vowel E, is said to have a nucleus which consists of, well, which branches. What do we have with a word like stripes? What we have at the beginning is str. So this is a cluster, it's a consonant cluster. So the onset, in fact, consists of three parts, of three phonemes. Str. Then we have a nucleus, again with a diphthong consisting of two, and a coda which consists of two. So that's a fairly complex syllable. And we could look at what happens when several syllables follow each other, and a word like city would therefore consist of two syllables next to each other, which in fact look exactly the same in terms of structure. Now, in some rhymes, we don't have any branching. That's why we call it a light syllable. If we have branching in the nucleus, it's a heavy syllable. And in fact, if we have branching and a coda, it's also a heavy syllable. Or even just if there is a coda, it's a heavy syllable. Why am I telling you all of this? Well, it's got to do with various aspects, including what's possible in English to say, what's possible to form, and then also to distinguish between different syllables. Volcano, aroma, and potato. Veranda, agenda, disaster, synopsis. Cinema, avenue, liberty. What's different about stress here? Volcano, aroma, potato is not stressed on the first one. Veranda, agenda, but cinema and avenue and liberty. This has got to do with syllable structure. The stress is on the second last, the penultimate syllable, if that syllable is heavy. And stress is on the antepenultimate, namely the one before the second last, if the penultimate syllable is light. Okay. So, CAK, is that heavy or light? Is it heavy or light? It's one letter. Is it a diphthong? Volcano? It's a diphthong. Therefore, it's a heavy syllable. Therefore, the stress is on K rather than volcano. If I say volcano, I automatically don't produce the second syllable as a heavy syllable. And with cinema, well, then it's on the third last, or in this case on the first syllable, because ne is unstressed and it's light. Okay. So that's got to do with syllable structure rather than so the placement of stress. Sometimes you can make sense of this even if you don't know a word where it should be stressed. Remember, and I briefly mentioned this earlier on, there's a distinction between open and closed syllables. In open syllables, there is no coda. And in fact, there might even be syllables that consist of a single sound. O. O. It's just one phoneme. Closed syllables will always have one or several consonants. We might have a whole cluster. So vowel, consonant, consonant, as in and, or ants in three, with three then. And the word splints would have a consonant cluster at the beginning and a consonant cluster at the end. Okay, now it gets really specialized, but just to show you a little bit about what's there, there are apparently rules in different languages, or there are rules, that determine what's possible as these kind of syllable, as consonant sequences. If you want to read more about this, and that's in the reading again, I think, which was not for today, there are two rules that often take effect. The onset maximization principle and the sonority sequencing principle. No, you don't have to learn this. Okay. But it's got to do with the sounds of English being of different types of sonority. Vowels have a very high degree of sonority. They sound loud. But something like "ud" sounds much, there's much less to hear. And it depends on the sonority of a sound. It tends to be from the least sonorous to the most sonorous in a syllable, and then again to the least sonorous. And the onset maximalization principle says something about the fact that syllables should start with a consonant, if in doubt. So that explains why it's sending, because both of these principles are fulfilled. I'm not going to explain more about this, and I don't expect you to know this, but if you're interested, it's in the chapter on suprasegmental phonology, which follows the one that you were supposed to read for today. Right, which brings me to the last topic, which again is important, and which I would like you to have more active knowledge of. And that's what happens with what happens with words and phonemes and the structure of words, etc., in connected speech. And I've already briefly introduced the concept of assimilation. We'll see that again today. In one of the Lancaster, I used to work at Lancaster University, I think I mentioned, one of the exam scripts, someone wrote, "Someone who speaks RP, received pronunciation, or sometimes called BBC English or the Queen's English, would pronounce all their consonants at the end of words, whereas a Cockney from London would not." Is this really true? Well, I'd like to listen to the Queen with you, because she should know whether she speaks Queen's English or not. I'd like to play you a brief extract from a speech that she gave in 2002, just a week after her mother had died. And I would like you to listen to whether she produces all consonants at the end of syllables and words. Okay, here she is. I hope. Hello?
The ceremony tomorrow. I hope that sadness will blend with a wider sense of thanksgiving, not just for her life, but for the times in which she lived. A century for this country and the Commonwealth, not without its trials and sorrows, but also one of extraordinary progress, full of examples of courage and service, as well as fun and laughter. This is what my mother would have understood, because it was the warmth and affection of people everywhere which inspired her resolve, dedication, and enthusiasm for life. I thank you for the support you are giving me and my family as we come to terms with her death and the void she has left in our midst. I thank you also from my heart for the love you gave her during her life and the honour you now give her in death. May God bless you all."
So what about her aunts, for example? Love and... did she say love and honour? And honour? Should I just play it again? Or is it fun and laughter? Or did she say fun and laughter? fun and laughter, right? Yeah? Well, maybe given time, I won't play the whole thing again, but just show you. I mean, if you listened in detail, also if you put this through through the relevant phonetic equipment, then you would hear that the final plosives in many of her ands are not produced. Just so that you believe me, listen to this.
Fun and laughter. 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 Fun and...
You get the point, right? This is a typical joke that also makes use of the same kind of principle. You need to say this aloud in order to make sense of it, but when you've seen one shopping center, you've seen them all. Well, yes. Connected speech is different from looking at individual words. And in fact, sometimes in connected speech, we find combinations which are illegal in English. Well, which I've just, well, according to the rules which I've just given you, or many more rules that exist, shouldn't occur. We can make a distinction between what we could call an orthographic representation, how we would write it down, and then sort of the citation form, how you would find the... find the transcription in the dictionary if you looked up the word. But then we can also look at what happens in connected speech. It is cold. Right? It is cold. It's cold. Yeah? It's cold. It's really quite... It's cold. Sk is not a legal syllable onset in English. I mean, legal in inverted commas. Yeah? There is no syllable, no, there is no word which starts with tsk. But English speakers have no, and I'm sure if you presented one word to English speakers, they would find it very difficult to produce it. But interestingly, when they produce connected speech, they have no problems with saying it's cold. As I said, assimilation is a really important process. And I'll give you a few more examples and distinguish between different types of assimilation. We can look at words like that place, not words, but combination of words, like that place. And if I'm very careful, then I say that place. And that's how I would transcribe it then. But if you do this fairly quickly, well, then it's that place. That place. What do I do? I change the final element of the first word, which is a t, which is phonemic. Remember, I mean, whether it's t or p, is meaning distinguishing. Whether I say tat or tap is different words. Yeah? Okay. But if I produce it in connected speech, then I have no problem saying, and you have no problems understanding, that place. And you do not think that we are talking about the word dap, because it's connected speech. That keen. Not that keen, but that keen. So two velar consonants. Horseshoe. What is it, horse shoe, or is it not rather horseshoe? Horseshoe. Why does this happen? Well, we have assimilation that relates to what? It relates to the place of the articulation. And this is very, very common, because it basically means that you don't need to move something in your mouth. That scene versus das scene. Good newspaper, good newspaper. Not good newspaper. What's the difference here? D and N are produced in the same place, so place of articulation doesn't change. But what changes is the manner of articulation. This is less frequent than place of articulation assimilation. There are many other things that happen. I can only mention a few in connected speech. For example, I think many of these things are also mentioned in the reading for today. Potato. I don't say potato, but potato, right? Again, pt is not a legal onset, or very, very rare. Correct is not correct, but correct, correct. Because. So, the voiceless plosive assimilates to the following, no, sorry, the voice plosive. You know, it's because, but because. And there are many more, and I can only mention a few, as I said. Word final dentals and alveolars. How do you say last person? Well, last person. Last person. The last person I saw? Not the last person I saw. And I'm pretty sure the Queen would probably, well, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that she would sometimes say the last person I saw, and not the last person I saw. Well, depending on whether she's very careful in her speech, of course. Maybe in that speech she would have said that. But when she's talking to whoever she's talking to, I'm sure she doesn't. Always. Fifth Street. That's really difficult to say, right? Fifth. Fifth Street. Yeah. So we're reducing consonant clusters. Because they're difficult to produce. And that's basically what the Queen did, because N and D is a consonant cluster. There are some Englishes. Englishes is a funny plural, but yes, we linguists talk about Englishes, not just English, even though when you write it in Word, it says, no, it must be wrong, there can only be one English. No, there are other Englishes, for example, Singaporean English. And I'd like you to listen to this, and I'd like you to listen to the consonant clusters which are there, or rather not there.
So generally, most of the areas that we visited were very, what you call that, rural. It's not town, it's actually very laid back.
Town, not town, and not laid back, but lay back.
It's not town, it's actually very laid back.
Which is fairly common as a way of producing consonant clusters, or rather not producing them in Singapore English. Same principle, just sort of further developed in a way. Singaporeans also avoid consonant clusters in words like exciting.
It's exciting.
It's not exciting. Again, this is not because the phonemic contrast doesn't exist in Singapore English, but because of assimilation processes, or simply just processes of connected speech. Now, of course, when we talk about allophones and all those kind of things, then we're talking usually about the citation form, and we look at an individual word or the phonemes even that I introduced. But the point is, in connected speech, a lot of additional things happen that make things more complicated, more interesting, well, different. You're going to be let off again a few minutes early today, but I want to summarize the few important points that I would, not the few, but some important points that I would like you to take home from both phonetics and phonology. I introduced you to the sounds of English and how they were how they are produced, manner and place of articulation, voice, roundedness of vowels, front and back, and things like that. This is absolutely essential knowledge. I also introduced you to the to a broad phonetic transcription, which you will not you won't be expected to transcribe a whole sentence in English in the exam. Okay? If you can do it, good. Okay? You need to be able to describe them and to tell me more about where they're produced and how they're produced. Then I introduced you to the distinction between phone and phoneme. If you haven't got that yet, you need to get it. If that's where the tutorials are for, if you prepare for them with the exercises which are uploaded. I uploaded one last week, I'm going to do this again this week. Once you get it, it's really easy. Okay? If you haven't yet, you need to work on it, because it will come back as a concept again and again. And you should also be aware of the difference between the phonetic transcription and the phonemic transcription. So, just to remind you, in the phonetic transcription we would make a difference between water and water, because t and the glottal stop are two sounds. But in the phonemic description, transcription, we would not make a distinction between water and water, because the glottal stop and t are allophones of the same phoneme. Not in complementary distribution, but in free variation, or sort of variation that is because of social differences, age, region, social class. Okay. Now this is the absolute minimum that you need to know. You need to know more than that, but that's sort of, I mean, if you're struggling with this, then you need to start working. You need to start working anyway, but this is really important. See you next week.